From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, an effort in Milwaukee to help medical professionals better identify and treat young victims of human trafficking.
It is important, especially for youth. Sometimes youth, they don't even understand what's happening to them. They don't realize that it's exploitation. So even asking the question and screening can be a way of educating them.
Later, have we reached a critical mass of farmers markets in Milwaukee and across the country?
Plus, Milwaukee Magazine has suggestions for a cultural summer road trip across Wisconsin.
And Shakespeare in the Park's production this summer is in part a reaction to a tough time for the world.
I just wanted to do something that was fun. And I know there's been some approaches to Much Ado out there where they kind of explore the dark side of Much Ado. We are not.
We're working on the bright side, yes. Yeah.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Milwaukee's place as a hub for human trafficking has attracted media attention both locally and internationally. The Federal Bureau of Investigation confirms the city has a significant problem, especially when it comes to adolescents being trafficked.
But a number of organizations are undertaking efforts to alleviate the problem. Among them is Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, which is working to better educate medical providers in identifying and helping children who may be the victim of exploitation.
Dr. Angela Rabbit is a pediatrician and director of the hospital's Child Advocacy and Protection Services Fellowship, and Dr. Wendy Ehrman is a professor of adolescent medicine and author of a peer-reviewed article on the subject. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So we see statistics that show Milwaukee ranking near the top of major cities in a bad way for human trafficking crimes. How much importance and how much stock, I guess, do you place on the statistics versus the broader problem of human trafficking?
Well, the statistics are pretty difficult. It's a very hidden crime, so we don't have a good sense of how many victims are really out there. So I don't know if we can say for sure that Milwaukee is the top in the U.S., but we certainly have every problem that every other major city has.
And being a large city with a lot of the issues that surround trafficking, I think that makes us it makes it a little bit more of a public problem. I mean, we definitely do have a problem. Are we the worst? We don't know. And I don't really think that matters. I think understanding and being aware of the problem is much more of an important issue.
Right. And so give us a primer. What do you see playing into this dynamic? You know, you say being a large city with the issues that we have as a large city. What are the things that contribute to human trafficking being a problem here?
Well, one of the issues is our location. You know, we're kind of right in the middle of Green Bay and Chicago down south. So we're right in the middle of those two areas where a lot of, you know, Chicago's a larger city. Green Bay has sporting events, and those tend to be areas where we see a lot of trafficking. And so the area between here and Green Bay, the Fox Valley area, tends to be high in trafficking, and also kind of the Racine area down on the way to Chicago.
I also think that some of the things that Milwaukee struggles with, like poverty and discrimination and a lot of psychosocial issues among some of the families, contributes a lot to the issues that we see here.
Let's talk about, because you are both health professionals, and we don't always think of health professionals being part of the equation in terms of doing something about this issue. Where do health professionals and where do you see your work contributing to interrupting the cycle?
Well, I think I'm a primary care physician, so we sometimes are on the front line. We may be seeing these youth and not even recognizing it. So it's really important because most youth at some point need to obtain health care. So we may be the first ones that these kids come into contact with that can learn to recognize what's going on and be suspicious.
And if you look at surveys of survivors, almost 90% of them say that they did see a medical provider at some point during the time that they were being trafficked.
And are they typically seeing the provider for something that's linked to issues caused by being trafficked?
They can be seen for anything, but they do often come in for reproductive health care issues, violence-related injuries. The emergency department is one of the main places that they're seen.
Well, okay. So then let's talk about what you as physicians are able to do when you see someone. You know, first of all, how much do doctors typically know about, you know, indications that the person you're seeing might be a victim of human trafficking?
Well, we did a survey a couple of years ago of medical providers in Wisconsin, and less than half were able to actually appropriately label a victim as a victim of trafficking. So we know that medical providers haven't been very aware of the issue and aren't as knowledgeable maybe as we would like them to be. But I think we've been working pretty hard to educate, and I feel like there's been a lot more awareness recently. So I'm hoping those numbers will improve over the next couple of years.
Yeah, community-wide, this has become a hot topic. And so I think there's been a lot of information out there. The Community Human Trafficking Task Force has put out a lot of awareness campaigns on this. So I think there are more people that are starting to ask questions and to, you know, start to think about this issue.
Well, and so how are you going about educating the physician community at large?
Dr. Rabin and I have done a number of presentations for medical organizations around Milwaukee and actually around Wisconsin. So we go and we talk about the risk factors and what to look for and how to recognize it and then, you know, what you can do.
We also have an online training that we've developed that's on our website through our organization, POSI. So medical providers, if they want to look at that, they can go to posi.org to find it.
POSI is an acronym, right?
Yes. It stands for the Proactive Outreach for the Health of Sexually Exploited Youth.
Additionally, Dr. Rabbit's developed a medical student curriculum so that medical students can start to learn about this, which is really important because they're the next line, they're next providers out there.
Well, so as doctors and medical students who will someday be doctors, what can you or what can they do? What kind of position are you in to make change?
I think the first thing is the awareness and being able to recognize that somebody may be at risk for it. That's number one, because if you don't look for it, you're not going to find it, although it's out there. Just my own personal experiences, looking back, I can think of many youth that I've missed that looking, you know, when I think about it now, I can see all the risk factors that were right in front of my face, but I just didn't know enough at the time to recognize it. So I don't want that to happen again. Actually, I met somebody who, locally recently who's now an adult and who works in this area and realized after talking, you know, she acknowledged that things had happened to her as a youth and I missed it. I'm not going to let that happen again.
Well, right. So if you do recognize something as a doctor, what can you do?
I think the first thing is to you recognize it and then to develop a relationship with the youth because they're not always very trusting at first. You know, offer them services. A lot of times there's a lot of trauma that these youth have gone through, so they may not be willing at first to come out and admit things to you. And even sometimes they're not willing to accept help. So developing that trusting relationship, offering them services. I mean, these youth need contraceptive management. They need testing for sexually transmitted diseases. They can have other health-related issues that aren't being taken care of, including malnutrition, obesity, chronic issues that haven't been taken care of, dental issues. So, you know, trying to address what they're willing to accept and then developing a relationship so you can get them back.
And also knowing how to approach them, knowing how to ask the question, I think is important. A lot of medical providers don't screen because they don't know how to ask. But it is important, especially for youth. Sometimes youth, they don't even understand what's happening to them. They don't realize that it's exploitation. So even asking the question and screening can be a way of educating them.
You can plant a seed, basically, in them that they know that you're a safe place to come back to if they're not willing to open up yet.
Do physicians have a requirement? Are there requirements if they recognize that something like this is going on?
It depends on the age. For adults, we're not required to report to law enforcement. It's a lot like domestic violence. We can report if the patient wants us to report. For minors, and in Wisconsin, a minor is someone less than 18 years of age, we are mandated reporters. So if we have a reasonable suspicion that the child's being exploited, we do have to report it to Child Protective Services and law enforcement.
You say, knowing what you know now about the issue, you've gone back and reevaluated your interactions with patients from years past. And I mean, that must be at some level kind of heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, are you now today seeing successes either with your own practice or from what you understand being part of this field that there are doctors that are already making a difference on sort of the front lines of this?
I think that, you know, through our trainings that some of the residents and students have now become more aware of this and are not afraid to ask questions. They also know if they have a question that they can contact us. So I think that's important. People are no longer afraid to ask because people don't ask if they're not going to ask about something that they can't take care of. You know, then they don't. What are they going to ask for if they can't do anything about it?
We've also been able to develop relationships with investigators and really work on the way we communicate and the way we handle these cases. And so, you know, one of the issues for medical providers is, well, I don't know if I want to ask because if I do, is anything good really going to happen? But there's a lot happening in Wisconsin kind of from the investigative side. So now things are happening and we're moving in the right direction in terms of our community response.
The other big change that we have now is the victim advocacy law, which allows victims, they show up in the emergency room, they can request to have an advocate with them. We don't have enough of them yet, but we do have that option, and there are some people in Milwaukee who will come and be at the side of some of these youth that they need that extra support, who aren't going to be a police officer, aren't going to be a social worker, and making those relationships has been tremendous.
Is this training and are these guidelines, are they designed just for physicians, or are we talking about medical providers at all levels, nurses, physician assistants, other people that patients might encounter along the way?
They're really developed for medical providers, which can include physicians, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, anyone that is providing the care for youth. Also, social workers that work in healthcare setting can utilize them as well.
Where do you see things needing to go from here, given that you're already working to reach more? You know, you've talked about reaching medical students. You talk about reaching a higher percentage of doctors in the region. Where do you see things needing to go beyond that point?
In terms of the medical response, we would really like to engage other health systems beyond Children's Hospital and the medical college to help them, you know, develop their responses based on the experiences that we've had. We could be a resource for that.
Well, Wendy Ehrman and Angela Rabbit, thank you to both of you, both for spending some time with us and for the work that you do.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Wendy Ehrman is an adolescent medicine specialist at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. Dr. Angela Rabbit is an associate professor of pediatrics there. You can find links at WUWM.com to more about their efforts to educate medical professionals about identifying and treating victims of human trafficking.
A short break now, and then our series on agriculture in southeastern Wisconsin continues on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Summer is in full swing, and for many, that means regular visits to a farmer's market. Since 1994, the number of farmer's markets in the country has grown from less than 2,000 to nearly 9,000 today, and that just counts the ones registered in the U.S. Department of Agriculture's directory.
Many shoppers go to a farmer's market to support their local community, be environmentally friendly, also be more educated about their food, or maybe even to simply socialize. But they still represent only a fraction of the $800 billion spent annually on groceries in the United States. And they're only one of numerous options for consumers to buy produce. So how can farmers markets compete more effectively?
For our summer agriculture series, Full Plate, contributor Dave Kozlowski talked with Audrey Nowakowski about what's right and what's wrong with where farmers markets are today.
When they're working right, when all things are together the way they should be, you've got the community coming together to buy directly from farmers. It is really a rare opportunity for them to meet the person who grows the food for them. And they probably can't get it fresher. But it's also more than that. I mean, a farmer's market is the Greek agora. It's the community coming together to discuss politics, social issues, meet new people, and certainly talk about food. I've heard a lot of talk about food. And it's also an opportunity for the community or people in the community, entrepreneurial people, to try out new businesses. Farmers markets are often the incubators for new businesses. And they also provide a function of drawing attention to the existing local businesses around the market. So it's a beautiful thing. A farmer's market is a beautiful thing when it's working. Of late, though, there's been some stresses on the market that are maybe are going to cause it to adapt. Maybe some are adapting. But we'll see what the future is for farmers markets.
Well, and I know around the Milwaukee area, you can have a farmers market that's limited to a parking lot somewhere to one that sprawls across a major section of a park. So you mentioned some are struggling. What do you think is happening that makes a farmers market not work or kind of move away from its original ideal?
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure on farmers markets right now. To start with, farmers. There are a whole heck of a lot of markets. I mean, they've exploded since 2006 nationally, and certainly in our area they have. Southeastern Wisconsin must host something in the area of 25 to 30 markets. I'm not sure what the current number is in Milwaukee itself, but there's a lot of markets. And there's not that many farmers. So a farmer market without a farmer and a substantial portion of farmers is going to, I think, and I think some evidence suggests, weaken that market. I mean, people come to a farmer's market in part to see farmers. But if you've got so many markets and few farmers, they are either stretching their produce to hit as many markets as possible, or they're only attending one market, not attending another, and that's going to put, you know, an effort to try to find more farmers. So there's stress on the supply side, if you will. But there's also stress on the demand side. There are more options now than ever before for people to get produce, quote unquote, fresh organic produce, from everything to deliver to their door, you know, with something like Peapod, or the grocery stores themselves are stocking organic sections and are claiming farm fresh produce, and some are even using farmers in their ads to emphasize that they're you know, connected directly to the farm, whether they are or not. So there's that demand side draw for people. They don't need to go to a farmer's market. They can go to a grocery store, or they can order online for their product. There's also a sort of cultural one, I think, on the demand side, and that is people seem to be cooking less. And that's obviously going to have an impact on the farmers at the farmer's market. And it's going to have an impact on what the farmer's market is going to look like, because now to attract people down there, they have to have farmers, but they're also bringing increasingly prepared food vendors. Some farmers believe that that is taking money away from them. People are coming down to get their coffee, their donut, and their taco, and that's money that they might have been spending on produce. Maybe, maybe not. I'm not so sure about that, because those people might be coming down just for that. They never intended to buy fresh produce. And when you look across generational lines, there was some evidence recently in a trade pub that showed that roughly about 10% of every generation, Generation X, boomers, millennials, buy or go to farmers markets or buy direct from the farmers. But it seems to indicate, and I don't want to pick on millennials because they're picked on far too often, but it seems to indicate the data that they're more interested in the farmers market as a social thing.
Well, it definitely has turned into that, and some people or organizations get people to come to their farmers market because they'll have a weekly band or, mm-hmm. you know, rotating food trucks, as you mentioned, things right. like that to right. as an event, a social event. Right. But also for the consumer, for people who normally get their groceries, say, at a Pick and Save or any other type of grocery store like that, they can often find that buying the same items at a farmer's market could amount to be more expensive. Yeah. But what is the cost-benefit analysis of buying your produce at a farmer's market for the week versus
That's a good question. That comes up a lot, right. I would debate the initial premise that it's going to be more expensive. I'm not so sure that it is always more expensive. I think some items are. I think grocery stores use some produce as loss leaders so to draw people in. So there is that case. But what you're buying in the grocery store is, according to USDA data, at least, I shouldn't say every grocery store, most grocery stores and most items are at least 2 weeks old from harvest to the shelf. So in that time, that product has become less fresh. And because it's become less fresh, it's become less tasty. And there's some pretty good data that suggests it's becoming less nutritious. So you can buy a product that may be 2 weeks old, or you can buy a product that was literally, in some cases, picked that morning for the market. You've got markets like the West Dallas Market that opens in the afternoon, 1 o'clock, primarily so the vendors there, the farmers there, can pick their product in the morning and bring them to the shelf. That's really fresh product. And I know other farmers who get up at 4 o'clock in the morning so they can be out at 4:30 to pick their produce to get to a morning market. So that's really fresh. That is at most hours old. The economic advantage of that is product that's that fresh has got to have a longer kitchen shelf life than one that's already 2 weeks old that you buy from a grocery store. So taste and nutrition aside, just the economics of buying it, you're more likely to end up throwing away that head of lettuce that you bought in a grocery store after a week than you are buying that head of lettuce at the farmer's market after a week.
Well, and I suppose people probably feel a greater sense of duty to actually make something with the produce that they've bought directly from a farmer.
Because there is that pressure.
They've taken the extra effort to go there and buy those things too.
Yeah, well, we don't want to compel people to do these things. We want people to want to do these things.
Exactly.
But yes, there is. There is. They're making that extra effort to come down and to buy these things, in part because they feel compelled to do it. They just feel like this is something they need to do. And once they do that, then they start to sort of revisit their kitchen and revisit their cookbooks and discover the pleasure of cooking a meal for themselves or their kids.
It also takes down the environmental impact because the average distance that a food may travel to get to, say, the pick and save to your table is up to 1,500 miles versus having a local market. Even though farmers may travel to several markets throughout the week, there is cutting out that system, that distance.
Yeah, definitely. I try not to push the green issue, but it's there. 90% of our produce comes from California, Florida, or Texas. So it is being picked and refrigerated and then shipped across country, all which requires a great deal of energy, as opposed to the bushels of carrots or radishes or whatever that might be picked in Maguanago, say, and put on the farmer's truck and brought to the market. Are some of these trucks the most efficient ones? No. Would it be great to see this all on hybrid trucks or something? Sure. But still, the carbon footprint of the local vegetables is far less than that of shipped cross-country or across the world.
And we are seeing a unique change in the system of shipping and the automation of groceries, I suppose we can call it. As you mentioned before, things like Peapod that delivers your groceries or meal box subscriptions that send you food enough for one meal to cook.
With all this packaging.
Yeah, with all the packaging and people buying for a recipe versus for the week. And Amazon purchased Whole Foods, and their goal in doing that is to have more physical hubs within a couple of hours of a potential customer buying groceries. So while this technically reduces travel for food compared to what they are at now, do you think the problem still lays where the Whole Foods will get their supply from farmers ultimately?
It does. I am not sure how they define their hubs. Are they trucking it in still from California to these warehouse hubs and then distributing it from there? Or are they buying it local? I know Whole Foods was signing some contracts with local farmers of a certain size to provide them with their stores individually with produce. I think that's a good thing. I mean, I'm for farmers making a living. So if this is the route that it's going to take for farmers to get their produce to the hands of the community, so be it. But I haven't seen that yet. The logistics still seem to want to lean towards mass shipment of produce from mass growers of produce in California or around the world to their hubs and redistributed from there. Ideally, we'd go back to a world of local canneries and local dairies and Commission Row type places like we used to have here in Milwaukee, where farmers would bring their produce in and sell it directly to the consumers. And maybe that's where we're headed, but I'm not so sure that the Whole Foods Amazon deal, at least as I recognize it so far, is going to bring that to fruition.
Well, and on the note of farmers making a living, they, of course, impact their local economies. But in your experience, were you more successful at a farmer's market or through providing food to restaurants and your CSA? Because you, in fact, pulled out of farmer's markets.
We do. We have an on-farm market, but we don't go to any organized farm markets at this point. But we have lots of friends that do. And quite frankly, I miss the organized markets for all those benefits I talked about before. It's farmers are losing money. Nationally, farm market sales are down something like 1 or 2%. I don't really put much credence in that kind of number because it really varies from market to market, city to city, vendor to vendor. But what we're seeing around here, and of the folks I talk to, there's a loss of sales. Some blame the multiple option problem. Some blame the prepared food problem at the markets. The number of markets is bleeding the sales of other markets. So we're feeding off one another to maintain these markets. And so when you had fewer markets, those vendors in those markets were making more money. Now you have more markets, they're making less money. You can see that. I talked to one vendor who does both a summer market, a large summer market, and the winter market in Milwaukee. And their sales are up 10% at the winter market. One reason, I think, is there's not many winter markets. So you could see if the rise of markets has had an impact on the farmer sales.
What was that point for you where you decided that it's not worth it anymore?
Our sales dropped below $500. And we were making considerably more than that at the market. And we could see when we were there, people were buying their week's worth of produce. When it came time for us to make the decision to leave, it was clear that they weren't buying their week's worth. Some people literally came with a recipe and said, you know, I need 2 carrots, a potato, and, you know, a turnip. We put too much work, farmers put too much work involved in coming to a market to be able to sustain a drop in sales to a certain point. And that what that point is depends on the market itself. Is it a full-time job? Is it a part-time job? Do you have a lot of employees? You know, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody's got their own benchmark. When we saw it starting to dip down below $500, $400, $300, we realized, you know, this is really not worth it. We can sell that much off the farm without having to pay the licenses and the booth fees and all the insurance and all that stuff.
Well, on the note of what you sell at your farm right now, in this summer season, what's good to get right now? What kind of produce are you really excited about?
I'm excited about all produce. Well, maybe not summer squash, but I'm excited about all produce. It's a slow start to the season. Now, unless that farmer is a very innovative, aggressive farmer who's put up a lot of greenhouses, they'll have a good selection. So it's worth seeking out those farmers who have that ability. Or if there are farmers out west, away from Lake Michigan, they will have a little bit jump on the season too. I mean, you're seeing scallions, peas, lettuce, maybe some spinach. Strawberry season is probably pretty close coming to an end now. I know we're done with ours. But eventually, that stuff is going to take off, and the markets will be full. And I'm predicting a super fall. I think we're going to have just a boatload of good produce come late summer and fall.
Well, we'll look forward to talking about those types of produce as the seasons change and our next topic when you come in.
Sounds great, Audrey.
David Kozlowski and his wife Sandy Rodenz are owners of Pine Hole Gardens in Milwaukee. Kozlowski spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski as part of our summer series on Wisconsin agriculture, Full Plate.
Milwaukee Magazine's culture editor has some suggestions for a unique summer road trip. We'll hear more when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Thank you.
More of Lake Effect Now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Last week, our automotive contributors talked about what it takes to plan and execute a memorable summer road trip. You can hear that interview at WUWM.com. But even with those lessons in mind, it does take a destination.
That's where the July issue of Milwaukee Magazine comes in. They put a cultural stamp on Wisconsin road trips and offer some suggestions for a fun day out or two. Lindsay Anderson is the cultural editor at the magazine, and she's with us in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And welcome to Milwaukee. Let's talk about road trips. And in general, what was the idea behind the three road trips that make up this feature?
Well, I'd say that people associate road trips in general with the summer months. You know, it's nice to get out and take a trip when the weather's nice. But I think people tend to focus on nature-related destinations when they're thinking of typical road trip ideas.
Right. And Grand Canyon, or whatever.
And those are a lot of fun, too. But we thought for this issue it might be fun to sort of present some more culturally focused road trip ideas. And this year is especially interesting because it's the 150th anniversary of Frank Lloyd Wright's birth. And Wisconsin recently created a sort of trail map of Frank Lloyd Wright architectural destinations that people can visit. So,
right. And people who have driven around pretty much anywhere in southern Wisconsin have seen these signs. These are little brown signs along the highways.
Yeah, little markers by the highways sort of directing you where you might want to visit. And there are 9 total, so we went ahead and included 7 of them in the listing. And all of them are within a pretty short drive of Milwaukee. So it'd be easy to go to one or make a whole day of it and visit several in a row.
Well, right. So let's start there. A lot of people are aware of Frank Lloyd Wright's ties to the state of Wisconsin. But some of the stops on this, I mean, some of them are very well known. Taliesin, mm-hmm. People know around the world. But there are some other buildings that Frank Lloyd Wright had a lot to do with that maybe people aren't as familiar with.
Right.
Give us a flavor for just maybe one or two.
Well, I guess one of my favorites is the Monona Terrace Convention Center in Madison. I think that one's pretty interesting because it's actually only been around for 20 years. It's celebrating its 20th anniversary this year. Obviously, Frank Lloyd Wright has been dead for more than 20 years. So it's kind of interesting because they found these blueprints that he drew for the building that he drew up in the 1930s and were able to use that original design to recreate this building.
Right, this is
recently.
Like finding a manuscript from F. Scott Fitzgerald or something.
So that's an interesting building. They also host a lot of free events throughout the summer there. So I would definitely say that's a top pick for one that people might not be as familiar with.
And this is a good example of one that you can just go into without having to, there's not an admission fee just to check out the building.
Yeah, no costly tours, nothing like that. Also, if you're interested in other free sites to check out along the tour. The S.C. Johnson Administration Building is one of the sites closest to Milwaukee, and it's also always free. And of course, it was commissioned by the Johnson family, S.C. Johnson fame.
And this is in Racine.
Right, Racine, so not far at all. And they commissioned him to design several buildings on a sort of sprawling grounds. And the grounds themselves are very impressive, as are the buildings. And they're definitely worth a trip, too.
And obviously, Racine, just about a half-hour drive from most parts of the Milwaukee area. The furthest one away is in Richland Center, and that's really only maybe two and a half hours.
Right. And that one would be worth a drive, too, because Richland Center is actually where Frank Lloyd Wright was born. So I think it would be worth a trip to sort of see where he maybe got a lot of his ideas for his iconic prairie school aesthetic.
And the building to check out in Richland Center is a warehouse, is that right?
Right. Yes. It was commissioned initially as a warehouse in the 1920s. Now it's used as a sort of museum and gift shop space, and a lot of people host private events there. And there's tours offered there every 15 minutes throughout the week. So
very cool. So that's the 7-stop Frank Lloyd Wright architecture tour in southern Wisconsin. Then there's another section of this feature on theater to check out, which is, again, not something we think of in road trip terms all the time. What are some of the highlights of the Grand Theater Tour of Wisconsin?
Well, I think I should start by saying most of these are outdoor theaters, actually. That's sort of what we thought made them an interesting summer tie-in. a lot of people don't necessarily want to sit in the dark inside for several hours in the summer months. But these theaters, you're still outside. You're under the stars.
You can actually kill two birds with one stone if you're in Spring Green checking out Taliesin. You can also check out the American Players Theater.
Right. And I would say that's definitely one of my top picks for theaters to visit, too. It's one of the largest summer stock companies in the United States. And they've developed a great reputation for splashy, big-budget productions. This year, they're doing something a little bit different, though, which I think should be interesting. They're going to be putting on a production of Yasmina Riza's The Unexpected Man with several company members starring in it. It's going to be running through September. And so far, it's been getting great reviews. I think it's something a little outside the box and a little edgier than what they usually put on, but it sounds like it's going to be a great show.
Absolutely. Maybe mention one other. There are, what, five all told?
Trips to Door County are always popular, and the Peninsula Players is located in Fish Creek in Door County, and it's actually the oldest summer stock theater, not just in Wisconsin, but in America. This is their 82nd season, and I think anyone who goes there will see why they've managed to produce plays for so long and why people keep coming back year after year.
All right. And then finally, folk art is another is another part of the cultural road trip. And one of my pet peeves is people describing degrees of uniqueness. I tend to think things are either unique or they're not. But, you know, if you are going to describe a degree of uniqueness, some of these things are really unique.
Yep. Nope. A lot of them are. One of my favorites is probably the Dickeyville Grotto. It was created by a former pastor who wanted to provide his parishioners with a site for religious contemplation. So he started building a collection of kind of holy sites made out of concrete that he assembled himself. And then he invited his parishioners to actually bring back little mementos, trinkets from their travels, little keepsakes that had sentimental value to them. And any time anyone brought him one, he would just sort of embed it in the concrete and keep going. Yeah, so now it's encrusted in tens of thousands of just random objects, mementos, things like that.
Well, and if we're going to mention the Dickeyville Grotto, if your appetite for concrete sculptures is not sated by that, you should absolutely check out the Wisconsin Concrete Park, which is kind of a long drive, but very similar concept.
Right, yeah. It's
only
absolutely
maybe weirder.
Absolutely worth the drive. There were several folk artists who sort of collaborated together on hundreds of these extensive concrete sculptures. One of them also built a 260-foot arched fence running the perimeter of the concrete park. And there are just all sorts of sort of strange architectural oddities to check out there. A watchtower, a tiered fountain. I think it's something that could occupy your time for hours.
It would be a long day trip to drive up to Phillips to check this out and back the same day. So that might be a good weekend kind of thing.
Yeah. If you're planning a trip further north anyway, it could be a great stop to add along.
Now, I imagine a lot of these things are kind of new to you because you are kind of new to Milwaukee, right?
Yeah. I'm actually very excited to check out a lot of these for the first time, too. I have been to Dr. Evermore's Forevertron. It's not included in this list of folk art sites, but I have been to that one in Baraboo, Wisconsin, but I haven't checked out any of the other sites yet, so I'm hoping to this summer for sure.
And you were the brand new culture editor. Tell us briefly what you did before you got here and what you'll be doing at Milwaukee Magazine.
Yeah, I moved here from Chicago about 2 months ago. I was an editor at the Museum of Contemporary Art Chicago, and I also did a lot of freelance arts writing. So my background's mostly in fine art, but I've always been interested in, you know, other cultural offerings too, theater and music for sure. And so now that I'm with the magazine, I'm going to be planning the culture section, continue working on fine art-related content, and then also branching out into other cultural offerings too.
Seems like a perfect job to have to get to know a city.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I already feel like I have a pretty good sense of what's going on just because I've been planning monthly event calendars and things like that. And it's, yeah, been getting me very excited to go out and explore more.
Lindsay Anderson, thanks so much. Welcome to Milwaukee.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Lindsay Anderson is culture editor of Milwaukee Magazine. You can find out more and see some photos of the Wisconsin Concrete Park at WUWM.com.
You do not need to leave town or even spend money to have a great cultural experience. However, you can learn how to see a free production of Much Ado About Nothing when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio.
We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Tonight at the Marcus Center's Peck Pavilion, Shakespeare in the Park presents a free performance of Much Ado About Nothing. It's the latest production by a Milwaukee group that's been around for a couple of decades. For the last 8 years, the shows have been produced by a collaboration between Optimist Theater and Alverno College, but the Marcus Center's Peck Pavilion joined the effort this year.
Tom Reed directs the show, and Jim Pickering stars as Dogberry in the production. And they join me in the studio now. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
Well, first of all, the Shakespeare in the Park is kind of not in the park anymore. You're sort of in a park.
Right. We're still outdoors, but we're going to be at the Peck Pavilion at the Marcus Center for the Performing Arts. We're still outdoors, but now we're covered, and the audience is covered too. And we are super excited to be there. The Marcus Center has been really lovely. They've
it's
been
a different
great to
space.
Deal with.
It's yeah, a different space to work around, though.
Oh, very much yeah. So. Now, but one of the positive differences is we've always sort of moved into a space that was never really designed for live theater. You know, the Marcus Center, of course, completely understands what we're doing. So it's there's not this learning curve of trying to explain, you know, why we need to do things and how to do things. So from that side of the operation, it's much easier.
And there's already a stage there.
Yes.
You don't
yes.
have to build
it. We often have
yes,
to build
yes.
our own stage.
Yes, we don't have to build our own stage or build audience seating or anything like that. So.
Right. Our producer, Ron Scott Fry, one of our producers, is happy because he was the guy who had to build all that stuff. And now he just has already built a set to put on the stage. We're rehearsing in the Pittman Theater at Alverno, which is customary, where we've rehearsed a lot in the past,
yep,
which is very nice.
Yeah, we still have a partnership with Alverno College.
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice, too.
Yeah, they're great to us.
They don't mind that you're using another theater.
Oh, no. And we still use Alverno students in the shows and employ them. So, yeah.
We used to perform in the courtyard out there.
Yeah, well, that was the first one.
Mm-hmm.
We
right.
talked about the very first, and I don't remember which it was.
It was The Tempest.
Mm-hmm. And I remember it was in the courtyard.
Yeah.
So this is good. It's outdoors, but not.
Right.
Well, and there's running water for toilets and that sort of
yes.
thing, which is nice for mm-hmm. both actors and audience.
It is free, and there are parking ramps on either side of Kilbourne Avenue. There's the Marcus Center ramp, and there's the Milwaukee Center ramp. So
well,
it's
convenient,
and you won't mind paying for parking because
it's
the tickets
free.
Are free.
The tickets are free, yeah, exactly. And you were saying that they're even going to be busing folks in.
The Marcus Center for a couple of our performances, they're going to bus people in from other neighborhoods. So, yeah, we really couldn't ask for the Marcus Center to be more hospitable than they're being.
I think this is a great growth for the organization, too.
Oh, most definitely.
You're downtown,
yes.
you know, you've built, as my British friends would say, strength upon strength.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes, right.
It's there seems to be no lack of interest for people to come see Shakespeare.
Right, and I can't believe this is our 8th season. it doesn't seem like it's been 8 years.
All of our cells have changed since right. the thing started back.
We're all new people.
Yeah, that's right.
How come I didn't get taller?
See.
The cells changed. But
yeah, but you don't know how they're going to change.
That's
right.
true. Yeah. I was kind of hoping mm-hmm. that there would be a little height extra in there. But yeah, we talked about the very first one.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
and it's just so wonderful that it's managed not only to keep going, but to grow. And
right.
that you use the word that I love to hear around the arts, which is we're paying people.
Yes.
You know?
we still make it free to the public, but We're actually doing a few more equity contracts now, extending our run to 3 weekends. And yeah, and our pay has gone up a little bit also. All things we wanted to do. We still have the goal in the future of doing more than one show in the summer, but we're slowly reaching all of the goals that we had set. So right now the trajectory is on the right course.
It's wonderful.
So is the idea once you get to the point where you can do 2 shows in a season, is it still going to be Shakespeare, or are you going to branch out into other things, do you think?
I believe it would still be Shakespeare.
There's plenty to choose from.
Right. Good Lord.
Yeah. Yep.
Let's see what we've got. 29 to go. Right?
Yeah. Right. So quite a few years left. Yeah.
That's right.
Well, and so why Much Ado About Nothing this year? What was it about this particular Shakespeare that spoke to you?
One, there was the basics of this is a show that Optimist had been talking about doing for a while. And then logistically, this year, we felt that, honestly, we could afford to do enough equity contracts to do the show. But then just as far as our world right now, I just wanted to do something that was fun. And I know there's been some approaches to Much Ado out there where they kind of explore the dark side of Much Ado. We are not.
We're working on the bright side, yes.
Yeah. I want this to be a fun production.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it is.
Right.
I mean, this is some of the best dialogue ever.
I believe it has the highest percentage of prose in it, certainly of any of his comedies. Now, we have a wonderful dramaturg and text person who happens to be Tom's wife, M.L. Koger, who pointed this out at the beginning of rehearsals. And in a way, that makes it a bit more accessible than some of the other plays. There is some wonderful verse in it for you verse hounds out there. So you're not going to be deprived of that. But the conversation in this play, for the most part, is so straightforward and fun. Mm-hmm. And it's a great love story. It's almost like it's grown-ups acting like teenagers. You know, it's like, I don't really like you. No, I don't like you either. Well, I don't like you. And, of course, they're in love with each other.
I like you less.
Yes, yeah. Right. See, exactly. Yes. It's that kind of reverse sort of competition.
Right. And with that delicious language. I mean, they're having so much fun telling each other how much they don't like each other.
Oh, yes.
Right. And there's, one of the things we've talked about is the, you know, there's that thin line between love and hate. And one thing when you really look at the language that we're hoping is going to play is that Beatrice and Benedict, something happened with them before this play starts.
They got a history, right?
Yeah, they have a history, exactly.
She talks about it especially, right?
Yeah. And it's interesting after that history, but it's Benedict that cannot stop bringing Beatrice up.
That's right.
Yeah, it's true. He constantly.
Right. Every conversation, somehow Beatrice comes up.
That's right.
But I don't like you.
Right.
Exactly.
Not in the greatest light, but certainly she comes up.
And your part is so much fun, too.
Yes, it is.
You are not Benedict, and you're not Beatrice.
No, I'm neither of those people. Yeah. No, I'm Dogberry, the language butcher. And the head policeman of our island, which leads us to how we've set this thing, which is cool.
Okay.
Yes, yeah. Once again, looking at the play, in Shakespeare's day, if Don John had actually been a traitor, his head would have been cut off and it would have been on a pike at the foot of the London Bridge.
That's the prince's brother, right?
Yeah. So I was thinking maybe not the traitor route, so... And there were a lot of different avenues we went down, but we're setting it on an island, like post-World War II, 1950. And these guys, Don Pedro and whatnot, they were soldiers in a battalion together, but now they do a whole smuggling operation. And Leonardo has a bar and a hotel on this island, and it's kind of a remote island in the Pacific where sordid deals can happen.
Without much eye on them.
Right, exactly. Yes. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that's where it's set.
Shakespeare sets it in Messina, and he has soldiers coming back sort of for kind of an R&R situation. And that's sort of what this is. This is one of those islands where what during the war was for rest and relaxation, and some of the people liked it so much that when they were mustered out, they decided to stick around in order to stay alive. They go out and they, you know, plunder stuff.
Plunder,
and bring it on back and have all kinds of fun doing that.
I love the idea that He runs a bar and a hotel.
It's great.
That's fabulous.
What's the name of it?
Leonardo's Orchard.
Because that's what the stage direction says. It takes place in Leonardo's Orchard, so that's what we decided to call the bar.
Of course that's the bar.
And it's right. A tiki bar.
Of course it is. Yep. Of course it is. So this is sort of Bali High meets
Shakespeare. Meets McHale's Navy.
Oh. Right.
With Shakespeare somewhere in between.
With Shakespeare in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. And we have all just dated ourselves by making the McHale's Navy reference and laughing. And of course, setting it there too makes wonderful costume choices. I mean, if you're getting that sort of early 50s wonderful, are you kind of placing it in there in that costume wise?
Yes. Yeah. Christy Siebers is our costume designer. She works at the Milwaukee Ballet as a costumer.
One of the great themes of the costumes is, of course, after World War II, which was when women entered the workforce because the guys were all in uniform. And the popularity of wearing slacks started to appear. So we have at the beginning, we have a lot of the ladies in kind of mannish outfits, you know, kind of left over from those days. And they start dressing more and more feminine as the love stories begin to go forward. So there's a nice transformation. The story told through the costumes is really cool.
Oh, fun. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it sounds well. I was going to say trousers happened even earlier with like Katharine Hepburn.
Oh, sure.
She was doing that in the 30s and very stylishly, I might add.
But not blue jeans.
Not blue jeans, that's true. No, the Rosie the Riveter stuff
was
definitely the war. Well, I cannot wait. As you say, it's frothy with some undertones, and you can take from that as you wish, but it is just so much fun.
And we have a wonderful cast.
And one of the hints about it is with Todd and Kelly, who are both experienced actors, let's put it this way. You don't have to be just 22 years old to fall in love.
Right.
I love that about the story because it's two mature people who finally get it together. And
right.
I think that's a great story.
Fighting all the way.
Yeah.
But finally saying okay.
Yeah. And so our watch is a group of young people and they get to share the stage with Jim Pickering and get to, you know, learn from somebody like him.
Insofar as I allow them.
Right. I mean, you don't want to give away all your tricks.
So it's it's a great experience for them.
Well, and for us, too, because we're seeing the next generation of actors.
And it's also one of the things I love about Shakespeare in the Park is the percentage of people who are maybe seeing their first Shakespeare and maybe seeing their first play. And that gives us a responsibility that I think is very important, and that is we must be clear. Tell the story and be clear. Mm-hmm. And generally, if you do that, the rest of Shakespeare will tend to take care of itself. You know, so that's the fun part of it.
I look forward to seeing you on stage in July.
Thanks so much, Bonnie.
Good.
Tom Reed is the director, and Jim Pickering is one of the stars of Shakespeare in the Park's production of Much Ado About Nothing, which opens tonight at the Marcus Center's Peck Pavilion. You can find out more at WUWM.com. That is the Friday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mitch and I produce it, along with Audrey Nowakowski and Joy Powers, with the support of Mayan Silver and our interns, Eden Herbert and Katie Kokel.
We get additional reporting from Susan Bentz and Rachel Morello, plus web support from Michelle Matanowski and studio engineering from Jason Reeve and John Strelecki. Willie Porter wrote our theme music.
Thank you so much for tuning in today. Please be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
It is 11 o'clock, and stay tuned because fresh air is next.